Today's scripture reading comes from John chapter 13, verses 1 through 11. Now, before the festival of the Passover, Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart from this world and to go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. The devil had already put it into the heart of Judas, son of Simon Iscariot, to betray him. And during supper, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, got up from the table, took off his outer robe, and tied a towel around himself. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that was tied around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus answered, "You do not know now what I am doing, but later you will understand." Peter said to him, "You will never wash my feet." Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no share with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." Jesus said to him, "One who has bathed does not need to wash except for the feet, but is entirely clean. And you are clean, though not all of you." For he knew who was to betray him. For this reason he said, "Not all of you are clean."
I want to give a personal invitation for those of you who are visiting with us. Perhaps you've been visiting with us for a few weeks, or perhaps this is your first day visiting with us, or if you're a new member of North Lake, to stay and eat lunch with us today. We have a special lunch prepared. We call it the New to North Lake Lunch. We do it a couple of times a year, and Doris prepares this. And we want to make sure we didn't miss anybody, and we want to make sure that you understand you are invited. It's just a time to sit around the table and meet with some of the leaders of the church. You don't have to buy a timeshare or anything like that if you come to this. It's just a good time to be together and kind of see each other's faces and get to know each other a little bit better, to let you know how glad that we are that you're a part of this congregation or that you're visiting with us right now. And then if you have any questions you can ask, there's that as well. But it is a free lunch, okay? So there is such a thing as a free lunch. So hope that you'll stay. And if you didn't get an invitation to that for any reason, we want you to stay. Again, even if this is your first Sunday visiting with us today, please do stay around. So we're in chapter 13. Of the Gospel of John. And chapter 12 there is a bit of a transition in the Gospel. In chapter 12, we see how the raising of Lazarus that we talked about last week has made Jesus an absolute celebrity. The crowds flock to meet him. He can't go outside and people are all around him. He starts to travel to Jerusalem for the festival of Passover, and the crowds line both sides of the road and they're shouting for him. And the Pharisees say, "It looks like the whole world is going after him." And that's what it felt like to them. Even some out-of-town guests, Greek proselytes to Judaism who are there in town, they hear about Jesus. And they go to one of Jesus' disciples and say, "We would like to see him too." Now that seems like if you are a preacher, a politician, or a pitch man, that sounds like exactly what you want, doesn't it? That opportunity. But Jesus, when he hears this request from these out-of-town guests, he has a very strange reaction. He walks off the stage. That's it for his public ministry. He makes one last little plea to the people to walk in the light, and then he goes into hiding with his disciples. The crowds and the opponents fade away, and it's just Jesus now and the church for the next five chapters. Chapters 2 through 12 of John take about 3 years to unfold. The next five chapters happen over one night. He needs to show his disciples as it says here in the first verse of chapter 13, the end of his love, the full end, the full extent, the culmination. And he needs to help them understand what's about to happen, what they'll soon witness. And so he decides to wash their dirty feet. Now, in a place where folks went barefoot or wore sandals all the time and they spent most of their time walking along dirty roads and stepping over sheep paddies and that kind of thing, you can imagine how nasty feet would have gotten. At a dinner party, hosts were responsible for either providing water where folks could wash their own feet, or if they had a slave, they could task their slave with washing everyone's feet. But there was a strict social hierarchy within Judaism and within the Greek and Roman world as well on washing feet. A host never washed feet. A social better never washed the feet of someone who was socially below them. A teacher would never get down and wash their students' feet. A king would never kneel for anyone. And here's the picture Jesus has chosen to show them. He kneels to wash his disciples' feet. Now, there are two levels of symbolism in this act. Most commonly, we talk about this passage and we recognize that it's an act of humility, and that it shapes how followers of Jesus, and Jesus specifically says this, that we should treat each other in this same way. And so we see how this shapes the way that we are to treat other people. It rearranges all of our relationships. It rearranges any kind of social hierarchy. It completely transforms the idea of authority and leadership. If the one that we call Lord and teacher can wash our feet, then who is there that is beneath us? Who is there that we should look at and that they would be beneath our duty to serve? But let me ask you, if the only lesson to draw here from Jesus' action is kind of teaching about humility, then why does he tell Peter, "You don't realize now what I'm doing, but later you'll understand"? What perspective on this could Peter and the others have later that will help them understand what Jesus is doing for them now? As always in John, there's another level of meaning to go beyond that level of meaning on the surface. Everything about the foot washing here, the words that are used in the foot washing, resonate echoes of the crucifixion and of the resurrection. He rose from the meal, and that's the only time in the book that the word is used, and it's not specifically talking about the resurrection. He rose from the meal. He laid aside his outer clothing, and then when he finished, he took it back up. Those are the very same Greek words that are used when Jesus says that the good shepherd is the one who lays aside his life and then takes up that life again. And think, the next time he lays aside his clothing, he's going to be robed in purple and he's going to have this crown of thorns placed on his head. And then he's going to be stripped naked and he's going to be hung on a cross, which was the most humiliating way to treat a human being that man had then devised. So Mary, in that transitional chapter of 12, when she anoints Jesus' feet, and Jesus says, "She's anointing me for my burial." And so here, as he washes the feet of his disciples, he's revealing for them, he's interpreting for them the deepest meaning of his own death. As he goes to each of them, bathes their feet with cool water and dries them with the towel, and they look, they find themselves face to face with the love of God. How are they going to respond to this love? How should we respond when we're face to face with the love of God? Well, Peter, for one, he isn't sure how to respond. At first, he pushes Jesus away. You're going to never wash my feet. He loves Jesus, but this violates somehow his sense of the way things should be. Maybe he's just saying what's on everybody else's mind. We're willing to do the work. We're willing to follow you, to do what you've called us to do, to make the sacrifices, to treat you with the deference that you deserve. But when you do this, this rearranges the way things are supposed to be. This is not the way things are supposed to work. We wash your feet, and then we're going to expect that later on, maybe somebody's going to come along and they're going to wash our feet. Somebody's going to take care of us too. You just can't go around giving away love like that. That's not the way the world works. And Jesus says, unless I wash you, you have no part with me. And then Peter, well, he decides to take another. Well, then, Lord, not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well. First, Peter wanted to tell Jesus what not to do. Now he wants to tell him how to do it. He can't give up control in this situation. He can't accept that there's nothing that he can do to earn God's love. And notice how his striving to be in control and his thought that there's some way that he can earn God's love creates fear and distance in his relationship with Jesus. If you go on to verse 21, by the time Jesus says, one of you will betray me, Peter is either so afraid of making a fool out of himself by being corrected by Jesus in front of all the others, or maybe he's so afraid that he's the one that Jesus could be referring to that he's afraid to talk to him himself. He's afraid to speak to Jesus about it himself. And it says that he and the rest of the disciples could only stare at one another. Sitting in this room, staring at one another, at a loss to know which of them he meant. And then Peter motions to another disciple, one the gospel only identifies as the disciple Jesus loved, or you may have heard him refer to the beloved disciple, depending on how your Bible translates that. And Peter, by a nod or a motion of some kind, urges him, hey, ask that question of Jesus. Which one of them is Jesus referring to as a betrayer? Now, this is the first time in the gospel that we've seen this character, the disciple Jesus loved, the beloved disciple. And the beloved disciple is going to play a role here at the meal, then at the cross, then at the resurrection, and then after the resurrection in the stories that stretch beyond it in John. And finally, we're going to find out that the beloved disciple is the primary source behind this document, the Gospel of John. That disciple's witness forms the core of this gospel. And all of that, no matter how important this person is, we're never given a name. It remains anonymous. For some people came to believe it was the Apostle John, and there's some reason to believe that, and that's why the gospel bears his name. But we really don't know. And if it is John, or if it is anybody else that we should know about, for that matter, or a person who plays this prominent a role in the gospel, I just want, why keep this person's name anonymous? What does that do when you introduce a character who's going to be so important to a story and you deliberately leave them anonymous? What does that do? Does it make us start to wonder who this could be? Do we find ourselves continually questioning, who could this character be? And when, with the way that John's, or this author has constructed this book, you look at it, it could be anyone, couldn't it? Peter's wondering what to say next. The disciples are wondering, who's the betrayer? We're wondering, who's the beloved disciple? everybody's confidence is supposed to be shaken a bit here. Maybe we're all supposed to wonder exactly how we would respond when our faith is tested. This beloved disciple is pictured in the gospel here, literally leaning back on the chest of Jesus. Twice it tells us his location, how close he is to Jesus. Some translations miss the physical nature of his location, saying that he's just next to Jesus. But the text says that he's on Jesus' chest. It's a word that could mean innermost being or heart. And I think back to chapter 1, the end of the prologue, chapter 1, verse 18, that said, "No one has ever seen God. It is God, the only Son, who is close to the Father's heart." It's the very same word. Close to the Father's heart, who has made God known. So this beloved disciple is with Jesus in the same way the gospel pictures Jesus being with God. The beloved disciple is so close to Jesus, he can sense what's in Jesus' heart and make him known to the others, just as Jesus makes known the Father's heart. And here's where Jesus wants to draw each of us as disciples, close to his heart. And when the beloved disciple leaned back into the heart of Jesus, he asked him, "Lord, who is it?" And Jesus answered, "It's the one to whom I'll give this piece of bread when I've dipped it in the dish." And then he dips the piece of bread in the dish and he hands it to Judas. Now, stop for a moment and remember all that Jesus has done for Judas. He'd called Judas to follow, to be a part of his family. He'd shown him things that only God could do. He'd spoken to him words of life. And just a moment before, he had washed Judas's feet too. Knowing what was in Judas' heart, Jesus had still knelt before him and washed his feet. And now he shares with Judas this piece of bread. And did you notice how Doris, as she led our communion here, she walked over to Cindy and she wanted to share the bread with Cindy. And she wanted to share the cup with Cindy. And we've often looked at this, you know, the sharing of bread is just kind of a signal. Jesus is just kind of saying, here's a clue, a signal. But in that culture, and really in ours as well, to take a morsel of food and as a host to share it with a person is a special gesture of love. It's an invitation to create intimacy between us, to share something together. So what Jesus is doing here, what Judas would have perceived or was supposed to perceive in this, and what all the other disciples would have been supposed to perceive in this, was a special invitation to Judas. Come close to me. Be in deep relationship to me. It seems that even here to the very end, Jesus is giving Judas an invitation to come close, to be close, to find a way back to his side. Judas' motivation in this is just really a fathomless mystery, I think. Even the gospel writers seem hesitant to speculate on it. The Gospel of John says that Satan entered him. The devil prompted Judas to betray Jesus. And when Jesus offers him this bread, this symbol of intimacy and love, offered to bring him close in relationship, Judas can't accept it. He can't accept it. Perhaps he takes the bread. Perhaps it passes his lips. But he doesn't accept the true offer that's behind it. Maybe seeing Jesus down on his knees in that circle that night was the last straw for Judas. Maybe he thought that whatever good there is in this guy, that's not the way a Messiah acts. A Messiah can't get their hands dirty. Judas hadn't signed up for that. Maybe Judas wants spiritual power or political influence, but he's not looking for love. Maybe he's figured out a way just to make a buck here, just to get ahead. And he thinks, I'll take that bird in the hand. Maybe he's filled with too much self-hatred to accept Jesus' love. Or perhaps he's too jealous of others and their position who are closer to Jesus. Or I think even maybe like the rock band U2 sings in their song about Judas, and the name of the song is Until the End of the World. Maybe Judas did what he did because you miss too much these days if you just stop to think. Maybe we shouldn't just stop to think. Maybe he just didn't stop to think. Maybe he just said, it's not worth it to think too hard about this. I wonder how often Satan enters our lives because we fail to think. Because it's just too hard to pay attention to all the ramifications of our actions, and so we just react. And we assume that whatever feels natural, then that must be right. And Judas opens the door, and he walks out into the night. And he walks away from Jesus' way of life into the darkness. And as we've learned from this gospel, the dark is a very dangerous place to go. Here we are in that dimly lit room, shadows flickering on the wall, darkness surrounding them outside. And Jesus kneels and washes each of his disciples' feet. Three of them respond in very different ways. The beloved disciple, Peter, and Judas. I want to ask you, what separates them from each other? What separates them? They're not divided, are they, by those who understand and those who don't understand? Because really, does anybody understand? No one understands. None of them really understand. They're divided because some trust and stay, and others struggle to trust, but they stay. And then there's a third who can't trust and won't stay. One of the best pieces of advice about marriage that I've heard is, if you want to stay married, don't get a divorce. There's good advice in that, because what it communicates is there will come a time in every marriage, if it lasts long enough, where there will be doubt, where there will be weakness, where there will be a lack of understanding, where someone will consider giving up and walking away. But if you stay married, if you just don't get a divorce, if you can learn to trust, often, very often, I think, you come out on the other side of that so much stronger, really knowing what a marriage is about and knowing what love is. And the beloved disciple, he is close to the heart of Jesus. He's listening to every word Jesus speaks. He's close enough to tell what causes Jesus pain and what causes Jesus joy. He hears that heartbeat. Peter, he wavers. He loves Jesus. He doesn't completely trust. He trusts and then he fails and he fails and then he trusts over and over again in this story. But he keeps following. He doesn't leave. Judas rejects the way of Jesus. He removes himself from the life of the family of God gathered around Jesus. And he finds himself in the darkness. And I don't know about you, but I feel sorry for Judas a lot of times here. I mean, how could he have really known what he was doing? But on the other hand, if you've really known Jesus, how can you not know what you're doing when you walk away from life with Jesus? That U2 song about Judas has a thought-provoking ending, I think. Bono sings, he's singing it from the perspective of Judas, somewhere after death. And in the last part of the song, he talks about drowning in sorrows and waves of regret just coming over him. And then he imagined, it's this separation from God. And isn't that, I mean, what a picture, a nightmare that would be. And then he imagines Judas reaching out for the one, he says, that he tried to destroy. And then there's a wave of joy. And the last line from Judas, and everything's kind of left unresolved, but the last line from Judas is, "You said you'd wait till the end of the world." You said you'd wait till the end of the world. It's unclear, you know, in the song, how they, you know, really would... He's really singing of what will happen. But it makes me think, you know. It's what a good song should do, right? Make us think. Provoke us to consider something, to think about something. I'm certainly not trying to propose any kind of doctrine here about what happens after death. It's just a song. It's really no more than a hope. A hope. But that it would not be the first time that people thought a grave was going to be the end, only to be surprised that God was not done yet. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. May God forever surprise us with the extent of love that we experience in Jesus. And you may be wondering if God's love can reach you. Maybe you find yourself filled with doubt or wanting to trust but failing again and again. Maybe you've been out in the dark for so long that you're wondering if there's a place for you in the light. I want to tell you, Jesus is calling you to come into the light. Just to come close to the family of God is the first step in that. To be included in the family of God, to find your place. So I ask you, come near the heart of Jesus. Even if you don't understand everything, just trust that Jesus will show you God's will.